Welcome to the Hoops Hype Podcast. My name is Alex Kennedy. Joining me today is Ryan Hollins, who played 10 seasons in the NBA, and he's currently an analyst for ESPN. He appears on shows like First Take, Get Up, and SportsCenter, among others. You can follow him on Twitter at TheRyanHollins. Ryan, thanks for joining me. How are you?
Doing good, man. No problem at all, brother. Anytime. You know that.
Well, that means a lot. Thank you so much. These are obviously crazy times. How are you holding up?
Doing solid, man. Just enjoying the extra time with the family, obviously, but and it's tough, you know, work-wise, not having any NBA, any college, any basketball. This is really the time of year where everything heats up, man. So I think us, hoopers are really struggling with the time.
So what's it like working at ESPN when there's no sports? I mean, NFL free agency kind of gave us a little bit to talk about, a little bit of a distraction for sports fans. What's it like being at ESPN when there's no sports happening?
Man, it's tough. We really don't know what to do next. Everybody's kind of waiting and hoping that the NBA season doesn't get canceled in full. So just seeing what the next move is, and hopefully this virus can get contained essentially so we can move forward.
For sure. And I've said this before in this podcast, but I'll say it again. Obviously, much bigger concerns right now. We're hoping everyone is safe and staying healthy, but this is a sports podcast, so we do kind of cover it from that angle and talk about the sports aspect. But we'll get into your broadcasting career more in a bit here, but I want to talk about your upbringing, your NBA career. Let's start off with your upbringing. You grew up in Pasadena. When did you first get into basketball, and when did you have your big growth spurt?
I would say probably around the first or second grade, my dad put a basketball hoop in the backyard, and I remember coming home from school. My neighbor picked me up, which was really odd because she's never picked me up from school before. I knew there was something going on, and when I got home, there was a hoop there, and from that point, it was on. And I remember really my first basketball memories where I started like understanding what was going on in the game. I remember the finals with Shaq going one-on-one against Hakeem. And I remember seeing those two go at it, and being a tall kid at the time, I really fell in love with the game of basketball. I was pulling for Shaq. My dad was pulling for Hakeem. It was something we really bonded over. And then in 1995, UCLA won the national championship. And, from that moment on, I knew I wanted to be a Bruin. So it was, those two moments combined really just got me hooked into the game of basketball.
And was your growth spurt gradual, or did it all happen? Did you have one big growth spurt and then a bunch of little minor ones? What was that like?
I would say my freshman year, I came into the year 6'2", which is really tall, but, regular. And then, nothing crazy. And by the end of the year, I was 6'5", in the exact same school year. And then I came back the next year, 6'7". So, people were freaking out, like, well, weren't you just 6'2"? it was funny. It's like, I looked like a big kid. Like there's no facial hair, no deep voice, no nothing, standing about 6'5". So that's what, certain people could see, like, man, that's not normal, dude. You're going to end up being really, really tall. And, it was just like a late spurt for me.
Wow. And I know you, you were a high jumper too. I read that you cleared 6'10" at the Pac-10 championships. How'd you get into high jumping or the high jump?
Man, what's funny, man? I had a good friend of mine, and he went to my rival high school, PHS, and he was doing high jump. And maybe part of his PE, or back then in high school, if you did a sport, you didn't have to roll over and do PE. He played soccer also, and he was bragging to me, he jumped 5'8", and I go, I can beat that. And he goes, no, you can't. It's harder than it looks. And him talking trash to me, I went out and joined the track team to do jumps, and just one thing led to another, and I got started to progress. And after basketball season, your senior year, you really don't have anything else to do. You're kind of sitting around, and I really hadn't had that experience for the majority of my high school time. There was no spring ball or no summertime. You're really done. So track just made sense, and then I was like, hey coach, I'm gonna come out to the team, and next thing you know, I'm improving, and end up taking third in the state in high school, which was a wild experience because I never expected that to happen.
That's awesome. And then you get to UCLA. What was your experience like at UCLA, and how much did that help you in terms of your basketball development?
Man, UCLA was cool jumping. Man, some of the funnest times of my life, honestly, doing that. And I would say, what was crazy is I was athletic. I could jump a little bit, but I couldn't fly. Like, I remember when I came back from track and field, like, I was literally flying on the court, when I was jumping. But it took a while for my muscles to get used to. And, ultimately, honestly, I don't think I'd become a pro basketball player if I don't do track, because the muscle that I developed were they I mean, it was insane the way that I was jumping, and I didn't really necessarily expect it, but it was like, whoa, like where did this come from?
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, so that's cool that that kind of helped you on the court too. So I want to ask you about your draft night. You were picked 50th overall by the Charlotte Bobcats in the 2006 NBA draft. What was that night like for you, having to wait until the final 10 picks to hear your name?
Yeah, draft night was fairly stressful for me, because my agent told me I could go anywhere from 10th in the draft to 50th, and it was
Wow.
realistic, because I had literally, man, I had talent. I was strong. I jumped well. I benched well. I could, made jump shots. I was just, kind of blowing away the draft, to where, I remember even being up in Portland. And Nate McMillan kind of stopped the workout and like brought me into the office and was like, "Hey, like I love you. I want you to be a part of our team." I remember the Nets workout, went crazy like that. The Sonics workout, I think I jumped from the free throw line off 2 feet. So I was really blowing away, blowing through a lot of these workouts. And I didn't know where I would go. I was hoping it was somewhere in there. And my name drops all the way to the 50th pick. And what was funny is that my agent told me to work out for the Charlotte Bobcats. It may have been my last workout or one of my last workouts. And I remember telling him, "Why am I working out for Charlotte? All they have is the 50th pick. I know I'm not the third pick of the 50th pick." And I said, "I know I'm not going third. So I know I'm not going 50th either. I don't want to do the workout." And he convinced me to go and do the workout. And it ended up being the only team that took me. So it was a crazy experience, just emotionally, man, sitting there waiting and not knowing when you're going to be drafted with your friends and family there. And what was even crazier is I get drafted during a commercial. So I was mad, bro. I was mad. And someone told me I got drafted. And I said, "Yeah, right, man." And my
Man.
name went across the bottom of the screen. So I was just stressed, but I was happy. And then, a few moments later, Bernie Bickerstaff and Michael Jordan called me on the phone. I'm like, "Dude, is this real?" Like, it felt like a video game, bro. Like, Michael Jordan's on the phone talking to you. Like, I just couldn't believe it. It was like, "Welcome to Charlotte." Like, wow.
That's crazy. Yeah, people don't realize, the draft is such an inexact science, and for a lot of players, you're given this huge range. Like, you could go 20 to undrafted, and I mean, it is just crazy. And so many of these guys end up not really knowing where they're gonna go on draft night. So that is nuts. What did it motivate you going later in the draft? Because obviously, when you're thinking you could be potentially going first round and all that, was that motivation? Because I mean, just to be honest with you, going in the last 10 picks and then having a 10-year NBA career, that doesn't always happen. Some guys go that late and they never even play in the NBA if they're overseas or they're a draft and stash type guy. So is that kind of motivation for you?
It was absolutely motivation. I knew that the scouts had really missed out on something. I had a real chip on my shoulder, and I knew I was better than a lot of the guys that were getting drafted ahead of me. So for me, the motivation was crazy. And I just honestly, every team that didn't draft me, like I had a hit list, and it was like, "Yo, you're gonna know my name, and you're gonna see me, and I'm gonna catch you during the year." And my goal was to make people bite, eat a lot of those words that didn't come and take me. So that's when it came to the draft. That was my mindset. I had to go and improve myself. So it ended up working out.
Yeah, for sure. Was there a specific season that was the most fun for you, either because of your success or the team's success or the guys you played with? Does any specific season stand out as the most fun?
Well, if you're gonna say fun, I gotta say Lob City Clippers. I'd never seen a season that fun or that enjoyable. I mean, every game, we were blowing teams out of the water. Like, we weren't beating teams. We were blowing the NBA out. And we had two units that would come in and play at that high of a clip. I mean, both our units could have started. I mean, off the bench, you had this off the bench: Matt Barnes, Ronnie Turioff, Lamar Odom, Eric Bledsoe, Jamal Crawford.
Crazy.
And we could have easily started anywhere in the league at that time. So, man, it was just nuts. We would come in, like, I swear to God, like, it didn't even feel like basketball, bro. Like, we were beating so many different people that it did not feel like basketball.
No,
And
yeah.
it was just it was a blast, man. I mean, it was like 10 dunks a game. Like, I remember being in Staples and hearing just the crowd just scream, and I was like, yo, like, you don't get this. Like, you know when there's a once in a lifetime dunk, or every once in a while, like, a dude gets dunked on or something crazy happens? That would happen 5 or 6 times a game. Like,
Yeah.
I mean, Blake would literally jump over guys. DeAndre would catch something off the rim. I would get a dunk. Eric Bledsoe would come down, get a dunk. Jamal would go through somebody's legs. Like, it was a highlight the entire time. Or Matt Barnes would race down and get a highlight block or hit a corner three. Like, it was just like the crowd would be so loud. And like, our goal was funny. We check in, 5 to 7 minutes in, and we get our whole five in off the bench. And we were like, yo, our whole goal is to make sure the starters never come back. And half the times they didn't come back. And it's funny, teams literally, when they started playing us, they would leave their starters in the whole entire time, because we were just blasting. We were blasting teams off the bench. It was crazy.
That team was so much fun to watch. I can't even imagine what it was like to be a part of it. That's very cool. On the opposite end of the spectrum, was there a season that was the worst or the most difficult for you to get through?
Yeah, the toughest one was the second time when I went back to Cleveland, because I wanted to be moved and I wanted to be traded. And we had voiced that to the front office coming in. And, Semi Erdan was drafted there, like, stashed, and, came in. And, Chris Wall, not Chris Wall, I think I'm forgetting his
Chris
name.
Grant.
But yes, Chris Grant, he kind of told me, like, hey, this guy's here to take your minutes and to play. And I'm like, well, move me, because the Celtics want me and I want to play for the Celtics. And why don't you let me go and let me be moved? And they would not move me. And, going to a team when you have in the back of your mind that you don't want to play there, you don't want to be there, and the team is losing and your minutes are up and down, I was never committed or bought into the team. So it was just crazy coming into work every single day, knowing that. And then essentially, when I got moved, went from the maybe the worst scenario to one of the best scenarios, because I got a chance to play with Garnett and Pierce and Ray Allen and Rondo and Brandon Bass and all those guys, and play for Doc Rivers. And we won and had more success than I've ever seen in the NBA. I really felt like I was a part of something. So, ironically, those that like the tale of two seasons, everybody forgot that I was in Cleveland earlier in the year when I played for Boston. All they remember is Boston.
Yeah, going from worst to first is always nice. I want to talk about that first season in Cleveland, 2010-11. That was the first season after LeBron James left. The team goes from 61 wins to 19. It seemed like such a strange year from the outside looking in. What was that season like where this team is kind of trying to figure things out and deal with the departure of LeBron and figure out, okay, how can we rebuild and get back to being the team that we were before? Ironically, it's what ended up allowing them to land Kyrie Irving and different top draft picks, which is probably part of the reason why LeBron James eventually returned, because they had this nice core in place. But what was it like going through that 2010-11 season in Cleveland?
It was tough. It's like breaking up with your ex, and you're not quite over your ex, so all you talk about really is your ex. Like, there's like, we're so glad he's gone. Like, you
Yeah.
know what I'm saying? Like, those guys, and you're mad that he's gone. You know what I'm saying? So that was like a weird thing. Like, as a player, you want to move on. Or I remember when we played the Heat, it was more so, do this to LeBron. What about LeBron? Like, it was so selfish to me from a fan standpoint that no one cared about us. Like, all you care about is LeBron losing, rather than you worried about us as players. And, Anthony Parker, Anderson Varejao, and, Joey Graham, all those guys that were on the team that's what was, you know, for me, that was what was really frustrating and selfish from the fan standpoint. I'll say though that after, you know, I mean, that season, it was really tough. And, you know, from a schematic standpoint, you know, the entire team, JJ Hicks and all those guys were built to play off of LeBron. And then you take LeBron away and we didn't have anybody to create shots for us. So we just really, really struggled to score. And then, you know, Andy ends up getting hurt. You know, there's a number of injuries, you know, in the front line. Antoine Jameson kind of did what he could. But, you know, we struggled after that because of that. So, you know, taking LeBron out of the equation was incredibly tough, and there was no one really to replace him.
Right. That's how I always felt about it, that this was a team built with pieces that would complement LeBron. And then when he goes away, there's just, like you said, no lead scorer, and everything's kind of was different. But, you know, you mentioned that game when he returned to Cleveland, that game where he was, you know, with the Heat, his first away game against the Cavaliers. I remember watching that on TV and just thinking, this is insane. You know, the atmosphere seemed wild. What was it like being in the arena that night?
I'd never seen anything like it. It was just like, man, your head was on a swivel the whole night. I can't even, it's hard to even relate that experience to anything else, because nothing in my life compared to it. When LeBron first came in and there was such this anticipation, the boos were so loud that they sounded like one big roar. And it just sounded like, you know, boo, boo. Like you can single out individual. It was like a vortex, bro. It was insane. And it lasted probably 5 or 10 minutes straight. I had never in my life heard anything like that. And when he came in, it was just a weird atmosphere, and everyone was uncomfortable. And I think LeBron was still kind of growing into his own at the time. And I remember during the game, they end up beating us, they pull away. But LeBron tries to create like this Michael Jordan-like moment where he comes over to our bench and starts talking to our bench. And he was talking to Boobie Gibson, and it was like, you know, LeBron, that's not a genuine situation. Why are you over here? Like, it just looks so forced and so bad. And I think for LeBron, he had so much maturing to do because where he came from. And, you know, before, LeBron was always just used to things being handed to him. And LeBron really grew into his own and let those moments just organically happen. But he's just been used to doing so many amazing things. So I think that was part of his struggle. It's like, you know, he was young, man. And you had to find your way. But I mean, that night in itself was just wild, because it was just like bigger than basketball. And like, you had a lot of people there that still had LeBron's back. And like I would say, man, every 5 to 10 minutes, there's a fight breaking out in the stands. Like it was wild, bro.
That's crazy. Yeah, I agree with you about LeBron kind of forcing things. And he also, it seemed like, tried to embrace the villain role there for a bit and then realized, okay, this is not for me. You know, certain guys like Draymond Green, for example, they love the villain role. They're amazing in it. They, you know, they can embrace that perfectly. But LeBron, I think he's even said, that wasn't for me. That's not who I am. So I think it was something where he was still kind of trying to figure out who he was and how he was going to deal with all the criticism and everything that came with changing to a new team. So yeah, that was an interesting time. I had to ask about it just because I knew you were there that night. I am curious about this though. You played for 9 teams in 10 seasons. That had to be tough, not only from a basketball perspective with new coaches and new teammates, but also just having to move and never really getting settled down in one place for too long. What was that like for you?
Man, it was incredibly tough. I would say, you know, the toughest thing, I got used to it, obviously, halfway through my career. And a couple of guys aren't fortunate to get that far. But you never have a rapport, really, with one coach or certain teammates. So you don't get into a groove. So, you know, a guy like myself, I never know how good I could have been, because I was always learning different terminology, different strategies. And now, obviously, as an analyst, it works out because I can spot out what a team runs, why they run it, how they run it, what makes them special. And I understand the coaching aspect, but as a young player trying to figure the game out, you know, one coach wants me to set my screen and hold it. And then next year I'm getting told to set my screen and slip. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Or, hey, we're running pick and roll. All you do is pick and roll. And then, you know, you get with Kurt Rambis. He's like, well, all we're doing is posting up this year. So every single play or coach was just tough. It was tough. And it was absolutely different. So that for me, that was the craziest part. And people don't know that's what it's like being a pro. But you know, later in my career, those adjustments came immediately because I knew what worked. Hey, you know, you're supposed to defend and run and do X, Y, and Z, and you know, be ahead, be a couple steps ahead rather than steps behind. But for a young player, you know, that was very, very hard.
Yeah, that continuity with coaches and then with teammates too, that's just, I don't think fans realize how important that is. So that's so true. I mean, having to always be learning, and then just when you're finally getting comfortable, you may change teams or get traded or whatever. That has to be so difficult. One of the benefits, like you said, it definitely does help when you're a broadcaster, when you can when you've played for so many different coaches and know so many different terminologies. But another benefit is you played with so many great players over the years because you had so many different teammates. So I want to hit you with some superlatives, like best leader or things like that, and then you name the one player that comes to your mind and explain why you chose them. Sound good?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with that. Best leader. Who's the guy that comes to mind?
Kevin Garnett.
Oh, I love that one.
I mean, he had command of, you know, from the coaching staff to the locker room to the trainers. He's a basketball purist, and you know, we just did things the right way with Kevin at the helm. And I've never seen a leader like him. And I really see his importance to the game. I mean, I probably don't play another season in the NBA if it wasn't for him, because he taught me how to win in the NBA, how to approach a, you know, shoot around seriously, how to, you know, do, you know, prepare for the game, how to close games out, how to calm yourself down in big moments. I mean, he really changed everything I did for the better, man. And I mean, I attribute a lot to him. And I wouldn't have been the player that I was without him, because, you know, even just for him, just something simple as installing, you know, confidence in your teammates. You know, I didn't think you could play team basketball in the NBA, and for me, he taught that. That was leadership.
For sure. Funniest teammate.
Man, I got a couple. Jared Dudley. These are a couple ties. Jared Dudley, Lance Stephenson, and Tony Allen.
Oh,
To
yeah.
me, those guys were just hilarious, man. Just every day there was something. If it wasn't happening, like literally in the game, I mean, shoot, Blake and DJ are probably a tie. Like, they're hilarious, and obviously you see what Blake is doing in the comedy world. But there are so many guys to me that were just like absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, you can name a few. That's good. I like that. Smartest teammate.
Smartest teammate. Let me think. Maybe JJ Redick, possibly.
That's a good
You
one.
know, I mean, obviously, you know, like basketball wise, but I would say, you know, JJ's really, you know, analytical, and you know, like you'll see him on the plane. He'll have like a like the New York Times in hand, or like be reading a book. You know, there's a couple guys that are, you know, different. You know, most of us, we're listening to some tunes or watching a movie. You know, he's got a book in hand. So there are a couple guys like that. I'm probably missing out on a few, but you know, JJ definitely comes to mind.
And then a few more. Hardest workers.
KG, I would definitely throw in there as hardest worker, or one of the hardest workers. Let me think, who else, man? Who else can I get a gem as far as hardest worker? You know, intriguingly, you know, all of like, you know, you run across, you know, the fellow journeyman or the guy who came from the D League, you know, and those guys go really hard. All those G League guys were like, I mean, like just working their butts off.
Yeah.
Who else? I would say someone who's like kind of like, I wouldn't say just like a hard, crazy worker, but like you sleep on his work ethic, is Paul Pierce. You know, I remember I would pride myself on like getting to the gym really early or come back at night and doing stuff. I remember for some reason, man, I came into the gym about 6:30 after a road trip. You know, I got in pretty early so I could get out. I tell you, if Paul Pierce wasn't in the gym after a road trip, getting done at about 5 a.m., probably started at 5:30 a.m. in the gym. You know, people just didn't see when Paul put work in. But Paul, as it was a way of being obsessive about the way that he worked at his craft, and it wasn't for everybody to see. But one thing about Paul is, You play against Paul, he plays in slow motion, but Paul is an incredible athlete. But he's always deceptive. He always wanted people to think, oh man, think I'm slow, think I can't jump, think I can't shoot, you know? And then you look up and he's killing you. So Paul Pierce is, to me, he's definitely one of those guys.
And then two more for you. Best trash talker.
Best trash talker, KG, for sure,
Has
because
to
you can
be.
hear him across the you'd hear him across the whole arena. He would talk wild. He would say it to anybody. He'd talk to referees. He'd talk to opposing players. He had trash to say to LeBron. He had trash to say to I mean literally everybody. It's hard to shut him up. And at that moment, he's still not even shut up. And he's just gonna try you mentally before the basketball even starts. He's gonna test you out mentally and see where you stand with him. So KG for sure, best trash talker that I played with.
And last one, best guy or favorite guy to party with?
Favorite guy to party with? I gotta think. Who would be the best guy party wise? I would say the veterans who pay, man. If you went out with a Chris Paul or, like a Jason Terry or, if Jason Kidd showed up somewhere, whatever, like you know what I'm saying? Like everything was paid for. Like, there's like five limos outside, the bottle service, all like everything is like taken care of where the other regular guys, you're kind of on your own, but those super like vet max contract guys, veteran, like 10-year, you're going to be taken care of at whatever event you go to for them. That's going to be like an A++ event.
That's a great one. Free partying is always the best. When they're paying for it, it's a lot more fun. So that's a good one. So I want to ask you about your transition to broadcasting now. You and I talked about this for an article we did on Hoops Hype. I think it was 2 years ago or something like that. But we talked about basically athletes that are transition or have transitioned to the broadcasting world. And you talked about how you did the Sportscaster U course at Syracuse University. And for people who don't know, basically there's guest speakers, there's hands-on experience where athletes like yourself do play-by-play, color commentary, mock interviews, and things like that. So many of the athletes turned broadcasters that are on TV and radio now were a part of that course or took the course. How helpful was that for you in figuring out what you wanted to do after basketball, and what was that experience like for you?
The course was everything because I got to see whether I want to do it or not. It's like, all right, go do it and like let me know if you have a passion for it. Does it drive you crazy? Is this something that you want to be good at? How does it make you feel? When I first started getting my tape and my film back from broadcasting or getting in front of the lights, that drove me nuts. And it was like, man, this is something that I want to do. I really want to be good at this. So broadcasting just gave me the itch. Like, you talk about the itch. Like, I got the itch from broadcasting and at Sportscaster U. So that experience really got me, had me going.
And one thing's that you and I have talked about this, but that competitiveness that comes from playing, a lot of guys retire and then they can't replace that. But you've said that you feel that same competitiveness with broadcasting when you're going head to head against someone in a debate or things like that. How similar is that competitiveness, and do you feel like your role with ESPN kind of fills that void for you?
Yeah, it does. It does for the most part, because I always have in the back of my mind, somebody's watching. There's an executive or general manager or somebody or producer that's watching on another show when I get on. And whenever you play in the NBA, even when we go out and warm up, the veterans will tell you all 29 teams watch you warm up before you play. So don't go out sandbagging anything. There's guys with the pen and pads just watching you warm up, seeing if there's something that they're missing out of what you do. Hey, can the guy shoot a three? Because we're watching him shoot threes in his warm-up routine. And for me, anything that I go on television-wise, to me, that's always a tryout. I'm even when I'm posting content, I'm posting it for my boss. I'm not posting it for my friends. Even though that's nice for the fans, I know that the boss is going to see what I'm doing and hopefully enjoy the content I put out. And maybe I'll get an opportunity, even bigger. From the network.
For sure. You obviously were on TV a lot throughout your NBA career, over 10 years, playing different games and things like that, but people didn't get the same chance to know you or hear your thoughts and opinions like they do now with ESPN. So what was that adjustment like to where, you go from playing on TV and people know you as Ryan Hollins, the player, to now people know your opinions and your personality and things like that? Was that an adjustment where people almost feel like they know you when they come up and meet you or see you out in public?
Yeah, man. I would say twofold. It's like a for one, it's like a breath of fresh air that I think I get to express my opinions, and I get to say things that we would normally say in the locker room, but I can just be honest and speak my mind, and say if I think this guy is better than that guy, because when you're a player and you say that, it's bulletin board material. You don't want to be the topic of discussion. It's very, very frowned upon. That's not what you want to do. And now in broadcasting, like if I felt like a team did a good or bad job, I can go out and say that. So there was a strong level of refreshment. I would say though, it is a little tough though, because a lot of people, in today's day and age, in a social media era, people see you from your biggest clip. There's not too many guys like you that are diehard that know our personality. So, if you saw 30 seconds of Ryan Hollins on First Take or on Bleacher Report, that's who you think I am, because a lot of people don't know who I am. And, some people go, "Oh man, you're this or you're that," or like they talk to me, they want to start debating something or talking about something. It's like, dude, I don't want to talk about LeBron and MJ right now, but people think that that's what it's about, or I'm actually very analytical and, really like a basketball nerd in my mindset if we want to break down the game in X's and O's. And people just get fired up and want to hear the, who's the greatest of all time or who's the best. And it's not always what I'm looking to do,
Yeah, you're like, I'm off the clock right now. I don't need to do this.
Exactly.
Whenever you, so part of when you're having those opinions and, your different takes and things like that, sometimes there are things that are said that are polarizing, especially when you're talking about, greatest of all time and things like that. So, my question for you is, what is that aspect of the job like? Having people react to, like you said, oftentimes clips, they may see 30 seconds and even may take something out of context, but then they're reacting to it. I've seen your name trend on Twitter after certain segments, even where people are so fired up and they have to tweet what they're thinking and things like that. What is it like dealing with that, where you say something and all of a sudden everyone is talking about it and some of your takes just go viral, even in, and sometimes they're very polarizing. What's it like dealing with that aspect of the job?
I think for me, it's frustrating in the sense, and it's become a frustration. And I'll say this from the boss's aspect. It's frustrating me kind of with my bosses or kind of the executives or the people that make the call, and not in a disrespectful manner at all. But if I go on SportsCenter and my job is to break down what the average fan didn't know and educate the fan. If I go on First Take, my job is to debate and essentially, push news or push media. If I go on the show Now or Never, we kind of it's a culture-based, fun type of show. Every show brings a different flavor to it. So for me, if our job is to debate or create breaking news somewhat, it's not about what you say, it's how you say it. So I'm gonna break news. And I think for me to be stereotyped or locked into that, or people kind of buy into a 30-second clip, "Oh, is Ryan Hollins the guy we should be scared of?" Like, to me, you haven't done your homework. You haven't read your scouting report. So that kind of frustrates me of I guess you would say being labeled in that sense to by some people or even to me like the boss, because I feel like the fans are going to be the fans. The fans are going to take whatever media give them, or you, I don't want to say shove down their throat or whatever they buy on to, but thinking that someone isn't qualified to do a job or puts them in an awkward situation, I think that frustrates me in that element of, oh, is what is Ryan Hollins going to say? No, I'm going to go home and do my job, what's required of it. So I think that part for me has been frustrating a little bit.
Well, no, and you're right about that, where there are certain situations where, you're being forced to take a side and debate something, or you're being asked to come up with these different takes. Like, I used to work in radio, and my role in radio was very different than what I'm doing now, because you want debates, and if, two people are disagreeing about a topic, then it's more interesting, and you people call in and they react. So it's almost part of the job, and it comes with it, but it doesn't mean that's all you can do. So I totally see what you're saying. So I mean, how much of that is just, okay, I'm going on to this show, I know I need to have a debate here, so we need to pick sides and make this interesting. Is that part of it too?
Well, no, well, listen, it's interesting is like, we'll be in a pre-production meeting, and myself and Max or Stephen A. whoever, we'll actually agree. Will Kane, whoever, will agree more times than not on 99% of the subjects, but there's an angle in which we don't agree. So there's nothing that's manufactured, I would say. But it is for TV, because if I went on, I could put you to sleep. We could
Yeah.
talk about the triangle offense and, running the back cut and the read versus the back door versus flashing to the basketball, or, how to get a non-shooter open versus a shooter. You know what I'm saying? Like, we could run all of those things, but people would fall asleep and they wouldn't want to watch it. And I think just like my strong disappointment is people would judge something that was just written in the headline, like, well, Ryan Hollins said Rajon Rondo's better than Chris Paul. Well, did you hear the other 20 minutes of why I broke down why I said what I said?
For
Ryan
sure.
Hollins said LeBron James is this or that. Did you hear the other however many minutes? And it's funny, even we'll say, like, hey, when I felt like Giannis was not the MVP, there's a majority, a strong number of people that felt the same way that I felt. But somehow Ryan Hollins ends up being the basketball idiot. But I think that's part of the portrayal. And that's, to me, that's a frustrating part in that. I'm always going to feel confident in things I say and why I say them. I just would look for the justice and why it's backed up. But I do agree that there's frustration there. Someone just reads a certain clip and they take what they take out of the clip, or instead of reading, or, just it isn't given justice,
Yeah, and I mean, I would say this too. The people that agree with you aren't the ones running to Twitter to say something. It's the people who are worked up and that disagree. So you may hear from a lot of people that disagree with you, but there's plenty of people that watch that and they nod their head and just went on with their day. So you hear from a lot of the people that disagree and are really fired up and worked up, or who, for whatever reason, already have something against you and they want to jump at this and point something out. But the people that agree aren't going to say anything. So it does, I've experienced that too in this job, but whenever you are saying something and maybe it's polarizing, if there is a big reaction, do you block it out? Does it amuse you? How do you kind of deal with that?
I don't mind it till it starts messing with my money. And I've
Yeah.
had some of these situations mess with my money. And I've had to reach out to people. And I think, just to me, it's all like, maybe I'm just old school, or I still have like a Hooper's mentality where, like, hey, coach, if I mess up in the game, pull me to the side, let's have a pep talk. Like, hey, this guy's off limits, he's off limit, whatever. You know what I'm saying? And it's messed with my money in that I'm judged on, oh, he's going to say this or he may do that. And to me, that's the frustrating part, where it comes in, when it actually messes with financials or messes with opportunities. And it's go, man, can this guy talk to this guy? And it's like, or how does he feel with the players? When I see a player or a coach, they come up to me and say, man, you told the truth. Or if a guy has a frustration, I mean, I've talked to some mega stars, I'm not going to say names, and the guys that hit me and say, man, I didn't agree with what you said or why you said it. And I said, man, my bad, brother. And I would say, I'm not going to say a name. I say, hey, listen, I'm actually a big fan and advocate of yours, but did your people come back and ran when I say you should be an MVP, or I said you're a, these certain positive things about you? They just ran and took the one negative angle that was said. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I think it's a part of the game, learning experience. I don't mind it, I'm gonna be honest, but I would just love if people would actually dive in to what is said a little more than just a 30-second clickbait,
For sure. And that's why I love doing podcasts like this, because people can hear your point of view and hear your side on this and think, oh, wow, I guess I do overreact to a 30-second clip and maybe all the context isn't there. And so I think it's good to kind of, have people like yourself can come on here and kind of talk about what they're feeling and what that's like. So that's why I was kind of asking about it. Well, Ryan, this has been so much fun. I appreciate you making time to do this. I know things are crazy right now. So thanks for your time, brother.
Hey, man, listen, anytime, brothers, stay safe, man. And like you said earlier, you said it best, man. There's so much going on in the world other than basketball, but it felt good to take a little break, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Make sure you guys all go follow Ryan on Twitter at the Ryan Hollins. Check out all of his work. He does a fantastic job for ESPN. And if you guys want to hear more episodes of the Hoopsite podcast, check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere podcasts are found. And until next time, thanks for listening.